views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.
Welcome to Business Game Changers, where you'll hear expert tips on the big issues and the hottest trends to level up your business game. If you're building a career or building a business, this is Must Hear Radio. Here's your host, Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Conscious Business Radio on the Transformation Talk Radio Network. You are listening to Business Game Changers with Sarah Westall. That's me. I am having a wonderful show today. I am bringing back an interview that I did about 6 months ago with the founder of TED Talks. His name is Richard Werman, and he sold TED about a decade ago, and he made a lot of money on TED. But one thing that's interesting is he really doesn't like what it's all about now. And he doesn't like to talk about it much, so we talk about it a little bit, and then he talks about other things that he's interested in. And he's a colorful guy, you'll see as I do this interview. But before I go into that, I'm going to be talking to Albert Abel about Jovian Energy, which is so fascinating. This company is on the cusp of doing some amazing things in the energy field. And he's going to be talking about how to harvest energy from the quantum vacuum field. And a lot of people think it's not even, or the experts have for many years have thought it wasn't even possible to get energy out of the quantum energy field. But he has figured out, his company has figured out how to do that. And he's going to be on next week and he's going to explain all this to us. So make sure you tune in next week. But right now I have a short clip with Albert Abel.
You claim, let's get right into this, you claim to have the ability to create a device which requires no fuel, produces no waste, and supplies unlimited and continuous clean, safe, and affordable energy. How is that even possible?
You know, Sarah, that has been a point of contention ever since I came up with that phrase. In our business plan, I opened the plan by saying, imagine a device that requires no fuel, produces no waste, and yet produces clean, safe, affordable energy. And every time people would read that, they said, this sounds perpetual motion, free energy, or too good to be true. And quite frankly, that was a little frustrating because what I had to point out to people is, hey, I'm not the first person to do this.
Be sure to tune in next week, and I'll have the full interview with Albert Abel, the CEO of Jovian Technology. And, I mean, imagine having a laptop or a cell phone that never has to be plugged in, recharged, anything, and it just works. Well, that's what they are doing. So make sure that you tune in next week and hear all about it. But now I'm going to have Richard Werman on the show, the founder of TED.
Hi, Richard. Welcome to the program.
Nice for you to have me.
Well, go ahead.
I guess I will be either welcome or not welcome when the interview is finished.
Well, let's hope you're welcome. Well, I'm pretty excited to have you because you have done so many things. There's some famous things that everyone knows about, like creating TED and TED Med, but you have done so many other things that are very interesting that I want to talk to you about because I think those are the things that have really changed the business landscape, but people don't realize it's just the behind the scenes things and that they've all used but don't realize where the source of it is. And you've also written 83 books and you've done so many different things. And so I want to get into that. But before we get into that, I just quickly want to ask you a couple questions about TED and move on because I know that the future is much more exciting for you than the past. So let me ask just a couple quick questions for you. What was your intent for creating TED?
Well, the overriding intent of everything I do was an early recognition that the big design problem, and I'm originally trained as an architect and designer, the big design problem is designing your life. And so each thing I do, whether it is a conference or a book or a conversation or a trip or whatever, or some invention, is all to assuage my basic ignorance, my curiosity and my ignorance. And to put myself in a position like Ted, to be able to have the dinner party I always wanted to have but couldn't, to invite anybody I wanted to come and have a conversation, to do a book about a subject I don't understand, to have a conversation with extraordinary people, to invent new paths and new cartographies and new patterns of ways of looking at things. I mean, that's really it's when people call, a number of students call and want me to answer three or four questions because they're doing a paper and they want it, and their professor said, you ought to get in touch with this person, so they send me an email. And the standard answer for 90% of them from one of my assistants is, Mr. Wehrman cannot answer your questions because he doesn't type. He
doesn't. Well,
he would like me to tell you that his goal in life is to have an interesting life, and so far today has been interesting. And that's it.
I got to tell you, I completely understand your intent behind TED, because I think it's how I feel about this radio show that I do, because it's called Business Game Changers, and I get to talk to all sorts of fascinating people and fascinating topics, and it's really in line with what you're talking about. But you went on after TED, and you created TED Med.
I created TED Med while I was doing TED.
Okay.
I did TED, I did the first Federal Design Assembly, and I did the AIA National Conference, and I did the International Design Conference in Aspen. So, you know, I didn't come out of an egg.
You did. Well, yeah, you were doing a million things at once, right? You're like a typical genius guy that does a million things at once, and you want to have a creative thing, and one idea leads to another idea, and there you go.
At best, TED was an elaborate hobby. It never was my life. When I was doing TED, I was doing the Access travel guides and other things, and consulting to the Pacific Telesis phone company. I don't do one thing. I always do several things.
Well, and you talk about this Access city guides. Those are graphics and logical editorial organization to make places like New York, Tokyo, and Rome understandable to visitors. Correct? That's what I read in your bio.
They made them understandable to me.
And hopefully it's understandable to more people because of that.
But as it turns out, but they were done for me and my understanding, and the end result was that it did have an effect on others.
And it's pretty much the de facto guide, right, in a lot of these?
Oh, I don't know. I don't follow up on that. That's my past.
Okay. Well, this is something about your past, and I'm hoping that you're interested in talking about this because I think it's something that is important. Your mentor is Louis Kahn.
That's correct.
And why do you see him as your mentor?
Well, I did the first book on him when I was 26, and was my first book and his first book on him. He had been asked by a lot of people. I was working for him, and he was the master, the guru. And I was shocked afterwards that he had said yes, because he had turned down so many people. And then after he died, I did the collection of all the writings and speeches and that he had done, and none pictures of his buildings, just what he had to say and what others had to say about him. And the first line of the introduction, which is only a page and a quarter, the first line is, he was the youngest person I ever knew. And that's my goal in life. And it's what I hope that when I pass, that I've learned from him is how to be in a profound way the young person who says the emperor has no clothes.
And being young is a mindset.
Being young is an innocence of way of looking at something in a completely opposite way. Mr. Chow, the restaurateur, says, when I think I've heard the truth, I believe the opposite is truthier. Niels Bohr, the famous physicist, said, when I have a profound thought, I look at its opposite because I know that's profound also.
That's actually an interesting way to look at it.
And so my life is looking at things just in an innocent way. I don't work for anybody. Nobody's ever asked me to do a book. Nobody's ever asked me to do a conference. I have no clients. I just survive.
Well, it sounds like you're thriving, which is hard to do for a lot of people. How would you...
Fortunate. I am really fortunate that somebody as abrasive as I am also has a fair amount of charm.
People who are abrasive, people who are really bright and artistic tend to come across as more abrasive, and so they always have to work on that just so they can get their stuff done. And you do it naturally, huh?
I don't know what I do naturally. It's hard to, it's impossible to understand others and difficult to understand yourself.
I would agree with that. Okay, so your latest book is called 33, Understanding Change and the Change in Understanding. Why do you use the number 33? What is the significance of that?
Well, that's the last book that I published, I don't have a publisher. I don't have an agent. You can't get it in a bookstore. So it really is quite counterintuitive. But it is the last book that I published, but I'm working on a bigger book now. But what was called 33, because when I decided to do it, it was a sequel to a little fable I had written 33 years before, so I just called it 33. Since I'm doing it, I can call it whatever I want.
Yeah, you can. That's my, I play hockey, and that's my number in hockey. It's my daughter's number as well. So it's a cool number.
It's an interesting number, which I found out only after I decided to call it 33. Christ supposedly died at 33, but so did Evita Peron.
Oh.
There's a lot of 33s that come up, strangely. Now, I have also found that for whatever reason, I decide 17 is an interesting number. Then I start seeing 17 everywhere.
Yeah, that's how it works, right?
How it works, yeah.
I see business game changers everywhere now.
Yes, anyway, so.
How can people get your books then if they're not available in bookstores?
I think 33 you can get it on Amazon or as a used book, or they don't get them. I don't reprint my books. And so, the copies I have left, after a few years, I grind them.
Really?
Why would I lie to you? I don't know you well enough.
You're right. Okay, so you're the first person to coin the term information architect, and which, you know, I was an information architect when I first started out of college. So you coined my existence. But how did you come to that?
I don't try to get mileage out of that. I mean, there's an information architect society that has a convention every year. I don't even know if they know about me, and I'm not invited. And I understand to somebody else that it's going to be Information Architecture Day in April or something. They have 40,000 people going to celebrate it around the world.
Well, information architecture.
They haven't called me. I coined it because I was national chairman of the American Institute of Architects annual conference in 76, which was a big conference, 5,000 people, because it was in Philadelphia and celebrating the bicentennial. And they asked me to be chairman, and I called it the Architecture of Information.
And then it just went from there.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Well, and as you know, now that we have data everywhere, it's really becoming...
It's become a part of our language. And
yes.
I also did a book called Information Architects.
You're listening to Business Game Changers with Sarah Westall, and we have to take a short break. We'll be back in a moment.
Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. It's not warm when she's away. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone, and she's always gone too long. Anytime she goes away.
Enlightening, humorous, and compassionate. Listen live to The Kelly Ballard Show, insight and inspiration from the great beyond. Kelly is a fourth-generation medium and intuitive who covers topics ranging from grief, spirit guides, and listening to your intuition. Kelly can help you get answers and guidance from the other side with a little bit of humor and a lot of healing. Tune in to The Kelly Ballard Show, Thursdays at 1 p.m. Pacific Time here on TransformationTalkRadio.com.
tune in to Lucid Planet Radio with Dr. Kelly Neff. This hit show will illuminate your senses and empower you beyond your daily stressors and hardships. Renowned psychologist and author Dr. Kelly will captivate you with far-reaching topics and amazing guests as you wake to the greatest version of yourself. Learn to tap into your intuitions, think critically about our world, heal emotional and psychological wounds, and follow your passions to live your dreams. The Lucid Planet. Welcome home. Visit lucidplanetradio.com for more information.
What if there was no right or wrong way to be a great parent? Join Access Consciousness Facilitator Glenna Rice as she and Dr. Pat invite you to be the questionable parents you truly are and empower you to know and give the awareness required to create ease and joy with your children. Join Dr. Pat and Glenna as they focus on parenting for the modern family. Tune in every month to the Dr. Pat Show on air and online at TransformationTalkRadio.com.
Welcome back to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall with Transformation Radio on the Conscious Business Network. And we are going to resume my interesting conversation with Richard Warman.
So you also have something that I really want to talk about here. You have this live urban observatories around the world. That sounds incredibly interesting. What is that?
Well, I urge your listeners, and this is a very easy, if they have a pencil, I'm saying get a pencil out, get a pen out, get your iPad out, your iPhone. It's a very easy web application. I mean, it's free. I'm not selling anything. If you go to urbanobservatory.org/preview, I'll say it one more time, urbanobservatory.org/preview, you'll have 60, 70, 80 cities there. It'll go up to 100, then 1,000 that you can, for the first time, and I'm telling you the first time, and you have to believe me, really we've done all kinds of proof of concept. The first time that cities, you can see them comparatively, not only the same scale, but with the same legends, and about 25 or 30 levels of information compared, some of all of it live off the cloud, some of it actual live information about noise and weather and different things like that, and traffic. And the cities have given it to us. We've translated it into a new cartography so it can be compared. For instance, one city will call an airport and all that commercial, another will call it transportation, another will call it open space, another will call it public space. You can't compare the patterns of one city relative to another, or the population, or the this or that, or the scale of it, in any of this, it doesn't exist in our literature.
So
the first and only place you can start having a common language for comparing, where 51% of the human race lives.
How many different urban cities do you have?
We have, about 70 now, and I'll go up to 100 in a few months, and then I'll go up to 1,000.
Wow. So your goal is to get up to around 1,000 or whatever. What? So it's looking at all the detail, the cultural differences, and words create a lot of cultural differences.
I think you just look at it online. Look at this website, and you can bring up any three cities in the list and any one of 20 or 30 layers of information and compare them. And if you, if you make one bigger, the other one gets bigger. If you make one smaller, the other one gets smaller. You can change it. You'll find it really fun.
And what if you had a goal for this? What would you really like to see come out of it?
Oh, it's well on its way. It'll evolve the way it wants to evolve, and I'm on to my next thing. It'll be fine. It'll eventually have 1,000 cities. It'll be in three dimensions within a year. The maps will change, but the basic principles of comparative analysis will stay there, and it'll become a way that you can start then one city talking to another, or corporations figuring where they want to go, or people understanding what works and doesn't work places. It'll become part of a language. It's in a sense a primitive thing. It's the beginning of something. I mean, you wouldn't want to be operated on in a operating room where the doctors, one doctor uses the English system of feet and inches, and the other doctor uses the metric system of centimeters and millimeters to cut you open. So you want to have common language for doing things. Within sciences, they have different languages. There's very little standardization. We think it exists, but it doesn't.
Yeah, when I did a lot of data architecture in the day we did, I worked with University of Minnesota. I actually brought them in to train all the senior engineers at Belcore and me and all these people. And we learned through this process how one word can really mess people up. And if one word is thought differently by one person from another person, you can create a lot of animosity and a lot of problems just because they view that one word differently. And the important thing is to get on the same page from a standpoint of a word, and then you can get so much more accomplished. It was an interesting process that we went through.
It's true in every field. Astrophysicists and small particle physicists, both physicists look at the periodic table differently, our fundamental building block. They look at the word elegance differently, which is a physics term. Doctors use different words for things to mean different things. I mean, it's pathetic. So I'm an architect. I'm an urban planner. I love cartography. So I thought I would start at the bottom with cartography. And the first book I did when I was 26, I'm going to be 80 next month. The first book that I did when I was 26 was The Plans of 50 Cities in the World, all to the same scale. So I've been doing the same thing for my whole life. I'm kind of Johnny One Note.
It doesn't seem like you're Johnny One Note. But, okay, you have this incredible conference coming up, and I think it's really very close to what, you know, my genre is. And it's called the 555 Conference. It consists of five experts, five predictions of the future, game-changing patterns for 5 years in the future. Basically, finding the future first. So basically, me and you have a competition going on who's finding the future first.
I thought, for me, this is not for the public. I mean, there'll be some people come, I guess, but that's not the reason I'm doing it. Is I got tired of listening to speakers either selling charities, which they mostly do now at TED, is selling how to make a better world. I know that sounds un-PC. Well, I am. How to give to a charity and how to sell guilt. Or they're talking about their last book or their last building, or something like that. And I realized that the only thing that interests me is game changing, not incremental change.
Paradigm shifts.
That's fascinating to me. And 5 years is about the right time that you can make a prediction that has some gravitas to it. 3 years is what most companies plan for financially. 5 years, that last 2 years, is their uncomfortable zone, and that becomes the interesting zone. And then the follow-up two questions is, how does the world prepare, and what are the unintended consequences? So, for instance, if which will happen in the next 5 years, there will be a vaccination for the prevention of malaria, and therefore that will lead to a million people not dying, and that's wonderful. How does the world prepare for that when you realize that this mostly occurs? Those million people are often children in areas where overpopulated now, where they have a lot of children because so many die, and they need. Is a natural result of in births when there's a high death rate, the people have more children. So what happens is you're going to have a million children in places where they not only have a lot of children now, but they don't have enough to eat. So each year we will have a million more people living, which we should. It's wonderful. This is a terrific thing to cure malaria. It's been a death. More people have died of it than almost anything else over the last few centuries. However, you're going to dump them into a place where they don't have enough to eat. And if you don't prepare for the unintended consequences, well, what I'm saying is whatever you predict is going to happen, you ought to think of how the world prepares.
Because there's much more.
Always unintended consequences to every change.
Yes. Well, how about energy? What do you think's going on in the energy sector?
going to be a big breakthrough in battery life. It'll be about four times more, which if a car can go with the current batteries for 150, 200 miles, it certainly negates this whole charging thing, because you can charge it overnight any place in fast charging with a simpler grid and network. And it does away with the idea for gasoline, but it doesn't do away with the idea that you have to generate electricity.
Well, you always have to generate energy somehow, right?
Generate energy, and if it isn't by the end result spewing gas, you know, out into the atmosphere and carbon dioxide, how are you going to do it, and how do you set up the grid to then service a new form of battery?
Well, what do you think about solar and some of these independent sources of energy where you're not really on the grid?
I can't tell you anything you don't know, or your listeners don't know. So that's a question that I'm not an expert in. You're as much an expert as I am. We all know that you know, wind energy. We all know that there's sun energy. We all know that there's water energy. But those are things that we know exist, and there's going to be breakthroughs in those to help. You know, it all has to be, those are the unintended consequences. Which one has a leap forward because, or several of them might. It might be a hybrid of several different kinds of energy sources.
Do you think going to energy will, well, we know the answer to this, energy, changing the source of energy will fundamentally change our geopolitical situation?
What do you
think of some of that? I'm just trying to pick your brain and see what you think about things.
Every single thing that has happened will continue to happen. The change in energy and our dependency on gas, look what it did to the power in the Middle East, in Saudi Arabia, which was a country that had no resources, and then all of a sudden overnight became a center of money.
Yeah, Abu Dhabi.
Of wealth, because of
or Saudi Arabia. Yeah, there's also other things going on there, but go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, of Saudi Arabia. I mean, yes, of course, everything changes everything. You can't predict all the changes, but you can see some of the, I mean, there's going to be the Northwest Passage. You're going to be able to go from the Atlantic to the Pacific. You already has been several ships go through. It's going to be a year-round thing where shipping is going to use that instead of the Panama Canal, because you can have ships of any length. That's going to have an effect on Panama Canal and Nicaragua and also certain ports, in the northern Asia.
Have you been looking at some of the agricultural studies that they're doing where they're finding structures all over the world, and they're finding things that people don't realize are there? I mean, millions of structures in Africa, and the facts and things that they're finding is really changing.
I don't know what you mean by structures.
Well, they found millions of stone structures in Africa where there supposedly people weren't supposed to be. They're finding structures all over the place to indicate that we as a people were pretty civilized for a lot longer than we thought.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're finding bones that of animals that are, and they've found this for a long time, there's a lot of news clippings and a lot of things, of animals that are huge. Like, so they think that in the past we were much larger. Like they found animals, like they found turtles that were 10 times the size. They found, you know, fireflies that were bigger. I mean, every single animal, they found it to be a lot bigger in the fossil records.
Uh-huh.
And it's pointing to so many different things. You're listening to Business Game Changers, and we need to take a quick break, and we'll be back in a moment.
I walk along the avenue. I never climb.
enlightening, humorous, and compassionate. Listen live to The Kelly Ballard Show, insight and inspiration from the great beyond. Kelly is a fourth-generation medium and intuitive who covers topics ranging from grief, spirit guides, and listening to your intuition. Kelly can help you get answers and guidance from the other side with a little bit of humor and a lot of healing. Tune in to The Kelly Ballard Show, Thursdays at 1 p.m. Pacific Time here on TransformationTalkRadio.com.
Let the transition begin. Tune in to the hit show, Majestic Insights Radio, Success for Life's Transitions, with host Carrie Keith. Carrie is a gifted intuitive coach, healer, and teacher who will lead you through her empowering techniques of ancient wisdom and awareness so you can live your happiest, healthiest, and most vibrant life. Let Carrie teach you the tools of transformation that will help you experience success for all of life's transitions. To learn more about Carrie, visit www.majesticinsights.com.
How would you like increased health and vitality? How would you like to avoid the onset of disease as well as slow the aging process? This is all possible through a simple, safe, and natural process. Every day, we are either moving toward wellness or away from wellness.
Hi, I'm Mary Jane Mack. I'd like to be your partner in achieving optimal health. Contact me now at MaryJaneMack.com or call 425-392-0659. Visit MaryJaneMack.com.
We're back with Sarah Westall on Business Game Changers. You are listening to Conscious Business Radio Network on the Transformation Talk Radio. Now let's get back to my interview with founder of TED Talks, Richard Werman.
Well, a couple follow-up questions.
Yeah.
Yes, they found something bigger, but the way you're saying it is, in a sense, there's a certain way of interpreting how you're describing it is that bigger is better.
I'm not. I'm just saying it's different than what our understanding is.
Well, but everything changes. Everything is to think that why should anything stay the same? So some things maybe are bigger and some things maybe are smaller.
It's happening in mass.
Well, as an animal, we have about 1 trillion cells in our body.
Yep.
Of those 1 trillion cells, 90% of them are other animals. Only about 10% are human cells, unique to human beings. Those 90% are individual animals that you can find in LaRouche's book of animal life as separate animals with different names. And they all make up a human body. But they also make up the body of a buffalo. I mean,
sure.
That we are really zoos, not different species all the time. We are utterly dependent on and interconnected with other forms of life. Everything changes. And there, you know, when I grew up, and even when you grew up, if you took biology, you were told that all life comes from the sun and photosynthesis. The basic theory today is that more life comes from chemosynthesis, the absolute opposite. When it was first discovered a short time ago, 25 years ago, 50 years, not discovered, but postulated, about the black holes, it was thought to be the most vacuous place and everything would be sucked into it. And then the person who discovered it refuted that 20 years later and said, no, it's the densest part of the universe. The absolute opposite. So everything we know is going to be changed. There's nothing I've ever said or that I know now that I believe will be the truth or be accepted as an operative truth in 40 or 50 years. But you just live with these things as an operative.
Your paradigm is what it is today, and it'll continue to change and evolve.
It helps us live a life and make decisions fine, but you know it's going to change. I know it's going to change because it always has.
Well, what do you think about the idea that...
Not me at all.
What do you think about the idea that people fight that to a degree where it holds us back?
Well, now I'll say something that'll get you many letters, so don't give out my address. I don't care about people.
Oh, you care about me. You're talking to me.
No.
You don't care about me.
I have never met you. I don't know what you look like. I don't know what eye contact is with you, and I don't know you enough to say I care or don't care about you. I know that when I do a conference, for instance, I don't think for a second, for a moment, about who I invite based on who the audience would like me to have. I don't care about the people, the audience that's out there. Because I can't conceivably know what they're thinking.
So why do you...
Wait, let me finish this, young lady.
Okay.
Conceivably know what you're thinking. So what I try to do is good work. Historically, I know that the work I've done has had what seems like a positive effect on people. But it's not because I tried to have a positive effect. Nor do I follow up on what effect it has or doesn't have. I just try to do good work. My goal is to understand things, put them in a form that I can understand them better, and go on with my life. And try to do it well and responsibly and as honestly as I can. But I don't serve people.
You serve yourself.
I serve the work.
But the work is...
It's called Worship the God of Understanding.
But the work is honest, and it's good.
I try to make it as honest as I can, and I try to make it in a form that I can understand it. I recognize that I'm not very smart, so if I can understand it, likely other people will too, but I don't do it for that reason.
But anything that you do where you're honest to yourself and you do good work serves others as a byproduct.
I guess so. I don't know, but that's not my conscious effort.
Okay, that's fair. I think that's kind of healthy. That's healthy.
I don't care if it's healthy or not.
You do too, because you care about your own health, right?
I care about the work. I care about transforming my ignorance into some patterns of understanding.
But you care about your own health.
Yeah.
So that's what I mean. You care about your mental health.
Yeah.
And that's mentally healthy.
Yeah. Okay, you got 3 yas in a row. You win.
Okay. So when do you plan on having this conference that you're going to do, this 555 conference? When do you think it's going to be held?
3 places. The first one will be next September, and then the second will be a couple months later, and the third one will be a couple months after that. It'll be 5 predictions in each of the 3 places.
And will they be different or the same?
No. 5 different ones.
Okay. And do you have your experts all lined up, or are you still kind of muddling?
I haven't invited them, but I have it curated.
Okay.
And my success rate is usually fairly high.
Oh, I think so.
I mean, success in getting people to come.
So do you have any ideas of some of the things that you're going to be talking about?
I just told you 2. How many do you need? Why should I give away the show?
Okay, well then, I have some things. I happen to have some game changers that I would like to talk to you and get your opinion on.
All right, go ahead.
Okay, have you heard about the breakaway civilization concept that's been kicked around out there and a lot of experts are talking about?
Nope.
Well, the concept behind the breakaway civilization is that the education level and the technology has gotten so far in certain subgroups that they are disconnected from the rest of society, and the majority, especially in the United States, the mass amounts of money are going to that group, and they just keep getting farther and farther away from the base, or, you know, from the masses.
I don't know factually whether mass amounts of money are going to that group, but I will. You're going to say it, so
That's what's being talked about.
Okay, well, that's what's being talked about to me is not fact yet.
Yeah,
so
that's fair.
I don't want to, in a sense, even invisibly on the radio, nod at what you're saying until I have some real knowledge that that's so. But let's just continue your argument. Where does it go from there?
Well, you know, the point is that the money, the technology, there's a gap between the understanding. And this is whether there's money going to that, well, the money in Silicon Valley and other places are going to a lot of latest technologies. But the point is that there's a huge gap from what the average person understands and can implement in their paradigm in their normal life from the paradigms and the understanding of people who are engaged and engrossed in these environments.
It's interesting, and it's always been that way in some form. Always. I can certainly go back 2,000 years. We learned that the Bronze Age was one of those ancient ages, right? That was an early age. We look at our early history, thousands of years ago, and we look at the Iron Age and the Bronze Age, and we look at different ages, correct?
Yes.
Okay. If I asked you to ask the next 10,000 people you see to go out and in a day find you some bronze or make some bronze or tell you how you make bronze or where they would mine the copper, which is, of course, a major part of bronze, and figure out how to get the copper out of the ore, and then what do you mix with the copper ore, which is, there's two different things you mix with it to make bronze, and realize that those things that you mix with it, which are arsenic and tin, or tin, to make bronze, and those are mined about 300 or 400 miles at the closest near where you mine copper around the world, and realize how sophisticated and complicated that is to make enough bronze to make a great Chinese bronze urn, and realize that that happened thousands and thousands of years ago, and that thousands and thousands of years ago they had this complex knowledge, and we don't have any of it today.
That's what I was talking about earlier, which we can go back to, but keep going.
And they still make bronze, but they make it because a few people have that knowledge. And in the end, all the specialized knowledge for doing everything is always with a few people here and a few people there. That what you're saying doesn't mean anything to me, because I know how to do absolutely nothing. I'm talking to you on the phone. I wouldn't know how to make a phone, build a phone, or explain how the phone works to anybody, except in the most stupid, primitive terms. Next to it is a little box of Kleenex, because my nose runs in the morning, and I know the principles of making paper, but I don't know what that paper is made out of, whether it's made out of old cotton or whether it's made out of wood or it's made out of some synthetic material. And the making of the box, again, which is a different form of paper and wood, is very complicated. It's not such a simple thing. And in fact, the making of paper by Gutenberg, a kind of paper that he can dampen so it could go on his press and be pressed into the type, that was a breakthrough in itself, because they're mostly using vellum, which you can't do that with. So that's a breakthrough.
But, and that came from the illness, the mass, what do you call it, the plague that was going on. Right? Do you know that story?
I know all those.
You're way ahead of me. Go ahead.
I know all the plague stories and how the plague allowed people to not starve and had an effect on the manufacturing the invention of things to farm and inventions of the things to weave, because there wasn't enough people, but everybody had enough to eat, and it happened in the beginning of the early Renaissance. There's a whole bunch of, that's an unintended consequence of a horrible thing.
Bad things can make some good things happen.
That's right. That's what I was talking about before.
Horror makes you get out of your box pretty quickly.
Well, if you're the 2,000-year-old man, of course, 2,000-year-old man was completely apocryphal, because they were talking about cavemen with, Brooks and that amazing riff that he did called The 2,000-Year-Old Man that was so popular about 40 years ago. And when they asked him what did he use for transportation, he thought for a minute, he said, well, we didn't have buses, we didn't have trains, we didn't have anything like that 2,000 years ago. What we used for transportation was fear. Saber-toothed tiger came, we ran. What you're saying about money going to is absolutely, to me, it's not a new pattern. It's an absolute existing pattern that will keep on changing. It's a very natural pattern. I mean,
but do you think with technology and our understanding of things becoming faster and faster that there's it's more prominent today?
faster and faster. There's certain areas advantage, but the person who's making the computer or doing some of that science, you ask them to make you a flint spearhead.
You're right. They can't, most can't do
they
that.
Can't make bronze. That's the whole point I was making. They can't make anything that they're actually doing.
You're right.
So, no, I don't think there's any strange thing about it at all.
So my question to you
but
is...
What is happening is there's going to be, we are currently in the midst of a blurring between white collar, blue collar, and black collar. You know what white collar is, you know what blue collar is. Black collar is creative and technology. And there's a blurring between that and the four-year Bachelor of Arts degree in college, and that whole means of learning, that's in a process of radical change, and in the next 10 years will radically change.
We need to take another break. We'll be back in a moment.
Each Wednesday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, 4 Eastern Time on Transformation Talk Radio to Limelight Radio with Katina Macris. This is an inspirational, cutting-edge radio show educating worldwide listeners on a diversity of Lyme disease-related topics. Each week, Katina will interview some of the world's leaders in health, wellness, spirituality, and human potential. For more information, visit LimelightRadio.com.
Enlightening, humorous, and compassionate. Listen live to The Kelly Ballard Show, insight and inspiration from the great beyond. Kelly is a fourth-generation medium and intuitive who covers topics ranging from grief, spirit guides, and listening to your intuition. Kelly can help you get answers and guidance from the other side with a little bit of humor and a lot of healing. Tune in to The Kelly Ballard Show, Thursdays at 1 p.m. Pacific Time here on TransformationTalkRadio.com. Enlightening, humorous, and compassionate. Listen live to The Kelly Ballard Show, insight and inspiration from the great beyond. Kelly is a fourth-generation medium and intuitive who covers topics ranging from grief, spirit guides, and listening to your intuition. Kelly can help you get answers and guidance from the other side with a little bit of humor and a lot of healing. Tune in to The Kelly Ballard Show, Thursdays at 1 p.m. Pacific Time here on TransformationTalkRadio.com.
Okay, we're back with Business Game Changers, and I am Sarah Westall. You are listening to Transformation Talk Radio, and I am interviewing Richard Werman, who is the founder of TED Talks.
Well, how do you see that radically changing?
Don't radically change by taking the broken system, which they're doing now, and making it bigger. So there's a thing called Coursera, which now takes, they readily admit that the university system is broken, with a professor talking to 200 people. So now that same professor can now talk to 10,000 people at a time because of technology. So they're making a bigger broken system, and they're not in a fundamental way changing education into learning.
Well, because people need to think hard and work through problems and do and think and stumble outward. I had a professor that thought that learning is a stumbling outward process.
But you're missing my point. The difference is a board of education, not a board of learning. Education comes from the top down with specific things you have to take. Learning comes from interest from the bottom up. And so far, including myself, nobody's invented a viable, large system of increasing curiosity and guiding people in their interests instead of teaching them what's in a previously done book.
Do you know a lot of people trying to solve that problem?
You need guides to connect interest to interest to interest. If you're interested in anything, it connects to everything. Are people working on it? I don't know. I'm thinking about it, but I'm not people.
You're a person. You're part of the people.
But I'm not going to have that effect. But I'm interested in it.
Well, the issue, right, with education is that you need to have a certain amount of knowledge on all sorts of things in order to be able to do what you want in your interest area.
I don't agree with that. I think you can be very specialized and still have a very interesting life. And I think you can be a generalist and have an interesting life. I think we live in an age of also. You can be this way and you can also be that way. I don't think there's a way of doing things. I think it's much more complex than that. I think somebody can, sitting around a fire that they made by accident by a spark that hit some little furry plants and who learned how to really keep that fire going, can do that, and he probably couldn't hunt. And the guy that could hunt probably couldn't make the spear. And the person that made the spear couldn't have a baby. And the person that made the baby couldn't cook. And the person who couldn't, who painted on the side of the cave wall for their memories probably couldn't do any of the other things. It's fine to be specialized. It's also fine to be generalized. I don't have any, there's no formula for shit. It's just all the same.
The smartest person I've ever worked with was a person who had a fifth grade education. He didn't think much of himself, and he ended up messing up his whole life with drugs and things. But I think that points to your thing, that it doesn't, what you can accomplish and what you can do doesn't necessarily mean education. He could fix any equipment. You give him a piece of a broken equipment, he could figure it out. He could figure out anything faster than anybody I knew. And he only had a fifth grade education.
Well, see, I think it's the number five doesn't mean anything. I think you should have lifelong learning, and we should get rid of the word education.
Well, that's what he was. I mean, he just could.
Right, so, but the fifth grade doesn't make any difference. He probably learned his whole life.
Oh, I'm sure, yes, to be what he was doing.
I think in some things, you maybe should go to a very strict, organized way of learning certain subjects that might take 20 years. And that's okay too. And it can be a very rigorous and organized way of certain skills that you want to do. You know, I suspect to learn certain skills to go up in space or do that. If you have to learn a certain, when you're isolated in space, you have to have a certain group of skills that unlike anybody else's skills. And you have to be taught that in a rigorous way, and that's fine too. I'm not against that. I'm not saying what I'm saying is universal. I'm saying we should be given permission to find our path of our interest and have them absorbed by us in the most efficient way.
So you say that you're not good at anything. Correct. Or you're not good. There's a lot of things you're not good at. Well, what are you good at? Because I know you're... You're not, but you're better than most people at some things. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to do what you're doing.
That phrase you used, I have no idea what it means. Most people.
So you're good at nothing, and you're interested in some things.
I've been really fortunate to survive a life and that indulges my interests.
So you're good at creating things that people are interested in.
I don't. No, I'm good at creating things that interest me.
So you're good at creating things that interest you, and but
and that I've been allowed to do that is wonderful. This is a silly conversation.
I'm trying to get some things out of you. Okay, so what we can end this if you want, but what is, in your view, what is the biggest game changer that you see happening in the next 5 years, and then we can wrap this up.
The biggest.
The most impactful. How about the most interesting to you?
That's better. I think the most interesting to me would be a change in a workable way of setting up a learning system for large numbers of people.
Be sure to tune in next week at the same time. 12 noon Pacific and 3 p.m. Eastern to hear more from Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall, and if you want to hear any of my past shows or see what I'm up to, visit my website at sarahwestall.com. Make sure you like my Facebook page and follow me on Twitter, and also comment on some of these shows. I'd like to hear your feedback on what you think about today's show and any of the other shows that you listen to here. So for now, have a wonderful day.